Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks with Michelle Owen, Alex Crook and Sam Matterface.
Hello everybody and welcome to the latest instalment of the All Football Commentators Are Geeks podcast. Making up our geek squad today are
Michelle Owen from Sky Sports News and Soccer Saturday.
And I'm Sam Matterface, commentator for TalkSport and ITV.
And I'm Alex Crook, TalkSport commentator and national newspaper journalist.
Coming up on the pod this week, after the return of the Premier League, we've got the stats that tell the story of the weekend. And BT Sports main commentator Darren Fletcher speaks to us about his humble beginnings and how he almost didn't get the BT job.
If John wanted to go, it would have been John you'd have been talking to today. He was the first choice. I'd got no TV experience, so I'm thinking, well, you've got no chance, really.
Sam will also be explaining all about the mysterious new world of expected goals.
And I'll also have a tale from the tunnel involving Jurgen Klopp.
And how football managers are always watching what we're saying and doing on social media.
Oh, creepy.
With more pens than friends, this is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Well, it was another exciting weekend in the Premier League, unless you were me, who got the pleasure of watching Bournemouth's draw with Southampton and Everton's equally dire win over Crystal Palace.
Yeah, let's take a look at the main headlines in numbers.
Ross Barkley's dramatic last-gasp equaliser for Chelsea against Manchester United means the Blues have now gone 65 Premier League matches without losing when they are ahead at half-time at Stamford Bridge. And boy, did they leave it late to preserve that record. But what a fantastic finish.
Yeah, they certainly did. Liverpool were applauded for their free-flowing attacking football last season, but it's the Reds' back line propping up their title bid this time around. The 1-0 win at Huddersfield means Jurgen Klopp's men have conceded three goals or fewer in their first nine games for the first time in their 126-year history.
Mm. Wow, and Newcastle's 1-0 defeat at home to Brighton means the rock-bottom Toon are only the fourth team in English top-flight history to lose their first five home games of the season. The pressure's growing on Rafa Benitez.
Yeah, the spotlight beginning to turn from the boardroom to the dugout. Sam, you were at Huddersfield against Liverpool for TalkSport, that game we've been talking about. When we spoke on Saturday morning, you predicted an upset. That inevitably didn't happen, but you did have an interesting encounter with Jurgen Klopp in the post-match interviews.
That's not what I said to you, actually. I said, I think there'll be a story, if you remember, and you said, I'll quote you on that later, and then you've misquoted me. And a man in your profession shouldn't really do that. But yeah, I did bump into Jurgen Klopp, and you know, he's well known as a charismatic character, isn't he? He comes up with golden lines, which I think you, the written press in particular, absolutely love. He's great for clips, great for sound bites, very clippable. But to interview, he's actually quite tricky. And not for the reasons that you might expect. He just talks too much. He waffles on. It's great waffle, and he gives you a full answer every time. But his answers go on so long, you only get one or two questions. Now, this weekend in the tunnel at Huddersfield, he stopped the interview that I was doing with him midway through to point out that someone looked like Luke Shaw. Ooh, there's Luke Shaw. I was like, I'm not being rude, but lookalikes don't really work on the radio, Jurgen. You know, I would have liked to have asked him about the fitness of Henderson, Lallana, Mane, look ahead to Red Star Belgrade, but alas, I got a 3.5 minute interview, asked two questions, and had to edit out the Luke Shaw thing anyway. So next time you're thinking about giving me a little bit of jip on Twitter for not asking him this and that, you know why. This guy is not ever going to do a 211-second press conference like Jose, that's for sure.
He doesn't not like me, Jurgen Klopp. I've probably done him post-match on four occasions, I think, and every time he's got the hump about at least one of my questions. I even remember when they beat Southampton in the Cup, Daniel Sturridge had scored on one of his many comebacks from injury. And I just said to him, do you think now we can start to see the best of Daniel Sturridge? And his answer was, how am I supposed to know that? You tell me. All right, Jürgen, chill out, mate. I'm just giving you the chance to big up one of your strikers.
Yeah, but like most managers, they get the hump when you either they're on the back foot or they're under pressure or they're fed up with talking about an individual player or they're in the wrong or they just think you're stupid and that they know more than you. That's certainly the case, I think, sometimes with Pep. Manuel Pellegrini used to just walk off in the middle of an interview when I asked him a question he didn't like. Just walk off.
Do you think that some managers dislike some reporters?
Oh, Pellegrini hates me.
Really? Why?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Don't know. Just we had a thing. I don't know what it is. There's so, I think I get on quite well with most managers because I'm not that aggressive. But he certainly, for whatever reason, just didn't like me.
Mm. Yeah, that's definitely the case with me and Klopp. Speaking of managers losing their temper, Eddie Howe, usually cool, calm and collected, Mr. Nice Guy. No. I just saw a different side to him in the tunnel after that game against Southampton at the weekend. Bournemouth were expected to win. They never really turn up in this fixture. One win in seven against Southampton. It was another low-key performance from them. And the local BBC guy put that to Eddie and basically said, is this 2 points drop because, you know, Southampton is struggling, you're the form team. And he did the interview and then he came out and it's a very tight, congested interview area at Bournemouth. There's all kinds of different rooms and all the journalists sort of congregate in the centre. And I just heard him giving him a ticking off saying that was far too negative. That was a really negative interview. And actually, it changed the tone of my interview. And this is probably something we can discuss, the advantages of going first or second in that sort of scenario.
Yeah.
I was going after the local guy. And I changed the whole tone of the interview. In fact, my first question was, let's take the positives, Eddie. It's a clean sheet and you're still unbeaten at home.
Alan
probably wouldn't have asked
that
question.
Your tongue out of his backside after that. Was it? Did you have to be surgically removed?
But sometimes you do have to play that game, don't you? And it's interesting. Yeah. What the guys at home probably don't realise is that we all sort of try and get a feel of what's been said in a TV interview. Or you know, if we can, we actually listen into the radio interview that supersedes you, just so you know what sort of mood the manager's in.
I completely agree with Crook, because sometimes you might see an interview with someone before. I mean, we usually go first to Sky because normally the games I'm at, like, we're sort of the rights holders and you get to go first. But sometimes if it's been a particularly bad result for a team, you think, I wouldn't mind if the BBC went first or whatever. And you can see how they react. And like Crook, I'll go in and be like, well, you know, what positives can you take from that? And sometimes they'll shut you down and be like, well, how would I take any positives from that? But sometimes you just know you've got a brown nose a little bit before you can get into the nitty gritty, so you feel like they don't hate you.
Whenever I do in a game, usually with a rights holder, and if I do go and do post-match, which is not always the case, it's usually for a reason. A couple of weekends ago, the Mourinho story, and it's our game, and it's me who's got to go into the tunnel, and I'm thinking, crikey, this is going to be fun. But actually, I sort of relished it a little bit, and I got down there, and because we do have the TV interviews first, the TV always go first, then you can sort of see the mood of what he's like. And I thought, you know what? He's up for spilling a few towels here. And then when you feel like he's ready to, or any manager is ready to talk, you know what you can ask. You know what tone. But it is, like you say, Crook, it's about the lie of the land, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you just mentioned Mourinho there. And I remember the game we did at Bournemouth at the end of last season. It was just before the FA Cup semi-final and Paul Pogba had been left out of that game, and we got first dibs with Jose. And if you remember, I asked him outright, will Pogba play in the FA Cup semi-final? He gave us a cracking answer. We actually did the interview before BT Sport, who were covering the game, because they weren't quite ready to go. So we got it out on the air exclusively that Paul Pogba would play in the FA Cup semi-final. But the big moment was stolen a bit by Dal Winton. Do you remember?
Yes, he passed away, and that ended up being the top story for our esteemed colleague, didn't it? So they decided that was a little bit more important than Paul Pogba, which we weren't too sure about at the time. We thought it was a bit of an odd change of gear, but we laughed about it afterwards. Not laughed about Dal Winton passing away, that's terrible news, but just the way it was handled at the time. That was a Twitter storm. You've had a few Twitter incidents as well, haven't you, Michelle, where people have got hold of you afterwards to sort of have a go at you about something.
Yeah. So I'm gonna keep the manager nameless in this one.
Okay.
But it was a few years ago, an FA Cup third round in January, dismal weather, and it was a side that were a league above another side. They drew 0-0. This team had been playing really badly for weeks, and they put on such a bad performance. And I wasn't doing post-match that game, so I tweeted, such an uninspiring performance, pretty dire from this team. Anyway, I went off on holiday that week. I went to Dubai for a bit of winter sun. It was lovely. Came back.
Fancy.
And I was at, it was lovely. And I was at that ground again the next weekend. And I went to do post-match with the manager, and they'd just lost a big game for them. And he walked in and he went, "Saw your holiday photos." And I said, "Oh, right. Okay. Weird." Weird. Didn't
Stalker.
Know he followed me. Yeah, didn't know that he followed me on Twitter at this point. Like, somehow I'd missed it. And he's like, "Yeah, saw what you said about our performance last week as well." And just gave me the death stare for like three seconds. And I said, "Oh, well, at least you got a replay." And I was just stood there thinking, what have I just said? And then we just had to wait the most awkward silence while the cameraman set up. And I was like, please hurry up. Yeah. And then did post-match. And I've spoken to the media officer since about that incident and said, was he genuinely annoyed? He said, no, he just picks up on all of these things. And he said, fair play. Like, you came back with quite a good response. He probably respected you rather than sort of cowering down and being like, oh, I'm so sorry. But I just sort of blurted that out. And I'm not sure if it was a good or a bad thing on reflection.
You got to tough it out. You got to do the Alex Crook school of being brazen. It works every time. Just go back at them and then just keep turning up. Even if they ban you, just keep going. It's fine.
Remember, you can follow us on Instagram or get in touch with us via Twitter. The handles are exactly the same. We're at AFC Geeks. Send us any burning questions you have for us and we'll answer them in the next podcast.
Tweet the Geeks at AFC Geeks or get in touch on Instagram.
Okay, it's time for Stat or Spin. We did pretty well in this competition last week, so let's see who can come out on top and outfox their opponent this week. Michelle, do you want to go first?
Lift off and the clock has started.
Yeah, okay, so I'm going to talk about Blackburn Rovers because I'm covering them tonight. I'm at Swansea twice this week. The first game at Swansea I'm covering is Swansea v Blackburn. And this is my stat or spin. Of course, they were promoted from League One last season. And in doing so, Blackburn set a new club record for the most points in their history. Is that stat or spin?
I think it's spin because I think the most points in their history came when they were promoted from Division 1 to the Premier League under Kenny Dalglish, or it may have been Division 2 to Division 1 then, but it was certainly when they got promoted to the top flight, I think, in the early 90s or late 80s. So I'm going spin.
Crook. Okay, Crook.
I better be contrary and go stat.
Crook, just for being contrary, you are... correct, it's a stat. The second most points gained actually was in the 2000 and 2001 season when they got 91. And then I was looking back at the Premier League season thinking surely it was that season when they won the Premier League, 94-95. That was 89. But last season they got 96 points and the most wins as well.
Impressive. So just by being just sort of like, you know, no reason for it, just because he wanted to go against the grain, he gets a point there. I think that's wrong. I think maybe...
I do too.
I think it's wrong. It's just fundamentally wrong. It's not the spirit of the game. Anyway, Huddersfield manager David Wagner celebrated his 47th birthday on Friday. Did you know he was the best man at Jurgen Klopp's wedding? He celebrated his 21st birthday, making his one and only appearance for the German under-21 side, and his 24th birthday, making his one and only competitive appearance for Germany. Is that stat or is it spin?
No, I think that's spin, because I think he did play for the under-21s, but I don't think he played... Did he play a senior appearance for Germany? I'm going to go spin, because I don't think he got a German cap.
I don't either, but again, to be contraire, I'll go stat.
No, don't just be contraire. No, that's not the point of the game.
he just wants to win, that's the problem. The problem is that on this occasion, he's not going to win, because it is not a stat. I haven't got a clue what he did on his birthdays. It's totally made up. And he played international football for the United States of America. So it's just absolute rubbish. It's all absolute rubbish. Yeah, he played for America, 8 caps for the United States.
Oh, because I knew he played like for Germany, like at an unders level, I thought. But I don't know.
Did.
Well, I'm confused now.
Under 21 German international, but
so I had
international
that bit, right?
For the United States, yeah.
Incredible. Never knew that. Right, the Premier League table is stupidly tight at the moment, isn't it? You look at it, there are 2 points separating Manchester City in first, Tottenham in fifth. Meanwhile, Manchester United are looking very much in on the rest from their lowly position in 10th. We won't talk about that. But 3 teams, Manchester City, Liverpool, Chelsea, all unbeaten after 9 games. That's the first time that's ever happened in the history of English top flight football.
It's the third time, so spin.
Sam sounds like he knows what he's talking about, and he went first, so I'm going to go spin as well.
Oh, see, that's not the spirit of the game either.
I'm right. Getting it right.
It is spin.
It's all about the research, Crookster. And if you say it's tight at the top of the Premier League table, but we will prove to you that it is misleading you later in this programme, that is for sure.
Yes, we will indeed. Okay, coming up next, though, we'll be hearing from Darren Fletcher on Life as BT Sports' top football commentator, hosting 606 and covering the NFL for UK fans.
They don't know how to make small talk, but they do know when Raheem Sterling last scored for England. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Right, it's that time of the show where we introduce our special guest geek. And this week we sent Sam to seek out one of the country's leading TV commentators, Darren Fletcher, in the BT Sport outside broadcast truck ahead of Liverpool's trip to Huddersfield.
So we're sitting in the BT Winnebago.
We are. Mac has just walked in to get his pass.
Yeah, Mac has just walked in to get his pass. Sam, you're gorgeous. Not as beautiful as you. Yeah. This is a little bit different to how you started... Many years ago, I remember, I think we were working for the same organisation, Capital Gold Sports Network, I suppose it was, back in the day. You were in the East Midlands, weren't you?
I think I was a little bit further down the line then. I think you made a better start than I did.
Well, I'm not sure about that.
I used to put up suspended ceilings for a really dodgy building company, and we did the Lyceum Theatre in Sheffield. And from there, I got an opportunity to... essentially be a runner, I suppose, of some description, at Radio Trent, as it was. And they got Gem AM, they got Trent FM. Tony Della Hunty was my first boss, who'd been the sports editor at Pennine Radio on the day of the Bradford fire. Right. So he was kind of steeped in broadcasting, and he was at the top of the tree at the time. He'd done a remarkable job the day of the tragedy, where he'd literally helped talk people out of the stadium. Mm. You can imagine being part of that. So he was kind of my mentor at the start. And I was very fortunate because I got no experience other than being a massive sports fan. But he was the kind of guy that would give you a chance and then he'd give you all of his knowledge. And it was kind of down to you. And previous people that had worked for him within the building were Gabriel Clark, Julian Waters, who had gone on. And so you kind of got something to aim at. So you thought, well, they've done it. The difference being they were coming from an area where they were more educated than I was. They kind of decided that that was the job they were going to do. So he basically got my parents in. I was 18. And he said, I'm going to pay you £3,000 a year. And I'm going to teach him everything. And it's down to him. And he's got a bit of talent. I don't know where he saw that. He said, but if he listens and he works hard, he's got a chance. So I literally worked 7 days a week, did everything that nobody wanted to do. And that was it, really. And then...
What year was this?
This was 1990. So it was just after the World Cup. 1990. I remember the first story I ever wrote on an old electric typewriter was about the Argentina defender Nestor Lorenzo being linked with Forrest. I had no idea how to write it. And he just gradually gave me a bit more. And then he sent me off to go and do some reporting. So I'd do rugby union 1 week and I'd do football the next. I had no idea what the scores were in rugby union. I still don't know what they are now. So I used to write everything. So I'd be watching. I'd never watched the game hardly because I was writing all these reports because I had no confidence to do it myself. And then I gradually started doing some reports and it kind of led to doing a bit of off-air commentary.
Yeah.
And the goals were okay. I remember the first goal I commentated on, Teddy Sheringham scored it. It was an FA Cup tie for Forest. And I tried to say that he'd managed to steal a yard on his marker. And I said he got a mile of his yarker. So that was like the first one. So that didn't go too well. So it was just him giving me an opportunity, really. That was the genesis of it all.
So when BT eventually came to you, and this is probably 20 years later, when you worked at Five Live, you worked in the East Midlands, you've been on the radio for a very long time. How long did it take you to say yes?
It took them longer to say yes than me. I mean, I was going down there. I didn't think that I would be in the frame. And I was given an opportunity to go and speak to Grant Best, who was in charge at the time. I was at Five Live, and I kind of got my sights on thinking, well, Alan Green's not going to be there forever. And I think there was a theory in place that myself and John Murray would replace Alan and Mike. I think that was kind of what they were thinking of doing. But it wasn't really set in stone. So I went to speak to them, and I didn't think I'd got a prayer because they actually wanted John. They were trying to get John to go, John Murray to leave. John had got his sights set on being the football correspondent. That was his ambition. That's what he wanted to do. So I was fortunate there that John didn't want to go, because if John wanted to go, it would have been John you'd have been talking to today. So John didn't want to go. He was the first choice. I'd got no TV experience. So I'm thinking, well, you've got no chance, really. But I had the meeting with Grant, and we hit it off as people. And again, I was fortunate again. I was lucky with Tony at the start. I then went to Five Live, and Jonathan Wall, who was a producer at the time, said, listen, can I help you? Because you need a bit of help, and I'll help you. And I said yes. If I'd have said no, God knows where, because he then helped me, broaden me as a broadcaster, helped me and knocked the edges off and what have you.
And he ended up being the boss.
He's the boss now, and I work for him still, so that's great. I've got a great relationship, tremendous respect for him, a lot of gratitude to him. And Grant was the same. Grant kind of looked and said, you could do this, and I'll help you do it. So I've been lucky all the way that people I've bumped into have wanted to help me. So
I think that's something that everybody needs, though, isn't it? Sort of advice and shaping and education.
Do you know what, though? I see so many people, and people ask me to, they'll write me a letter and say, can you give me some advice? Or they'll want to talk to me on the phone. And I always say to them, it takes a long time, and you've got to be prepared to really hate it at times, because you've got to work hard. You'll have experienced this. You've got to stand in car parks in the wind and rain. But I get the impression now that the ones that are coming into the business want my job and your job yesterday. And it took me 25 years to get it. 27 years as we are to get to where we are. I was prepared to do it. Mm. I think people now think, well, if I'm not doing this in 3 years, I'll go and do something else. No chance. This takes a long time. So we then met, and I got my fingers crossed that I was going to get the job, because it was a massive life change for me, both in terms of salary, profile, opportunity. It was a different skill. I'd done two Match of the Days, and I'd not done them very well. So now I've got to go and commentate on the TV, and I'm thinking, I have no idea. So I was fortunate again that he was prepared to be patient. Ian Dark was here, someone that I could look at and learn from, see how he does it. And Grant was patient, was prepared to give it the time it took for me to get a bit more comfortable. But I'll be honest with you, I'm in my fifth year now with BT. And I think it's only the last 2 years that I would sit there and say I'm comfortable as a TV commentator. Because I'd done radio for so long. That I used to turn up to work for the first few years, dreading it, thinking I've got to get through it. Don't make a mistake. Don't talk too much. And social media can be a cruel place. But I've got thick skin, so I'm not that bothered. That was one thing I can handle. But it's only the last 2 years when I'm looking at my diary now thinking, I've got that game and I can't wait. And that game's a big game and I can't wait. But it took a period of time, and it was a real learning curve at my age to actually relearn the job that I've been doing for ages.
Is that because of the fact that it is, and it's underestimated, I think, a completely different skill from radio to television?
Bears no resemblance. The only thing that it has in common is that you're saying people's names, but everything else is different. And I don't know how you found it, but I found it so hard. I've got to say, when I watch you, I think your transition has been quicker than mine. Mine took a long time. When I watch you do it, you found a more natural TV rhythm, I think, quicker than I did.
Is that some crap at the radio, though?
No, it's not. I think it's a real skill, and I look at it, it's a compliment. And I don't know whether you're like me, but every game I do, I watch it back. Yeah. So I go home, and if it's a midweek match, I'll sit and watch at least half of it before I go to bed, no matter what time I get back. And then the first thing I do in the morning is watch the rest of it, because it makes me better. It's the only way I'm going to improve. But it did. It's just such a different thing to do. It's so different. And it was, I don't know what you felt like when you went to ITV, but when you walk in here as well, they're all at the top of the profession. And you're thinking, I'm holding everybody back here. And they're so nice. They're just nice people. They don't ever say to you, come on, mate, you're the weak link here. But you know you are, because they can do what they've been employed to do, and you're learning. So
they've been doing it for a lot longer as well.
So you kind of sit there and think, well, I'm holding these guys back. So it's nice when you get to a point where you think, I can now contribute properly. I can walk in without the pressure. But now I love it, and I don't think I'd want to go back to doing radio all the time. I enjoy doing it occasionally. I think it must be really hard to combine the two. I don't know how you find that, but you do both. I think I'd find that really hard. I don't think I'm bright enough to do both.
Two things that really fascinated me. One, that you started as early as you did at 18. And like you said, like me, we didn't go to university. We didn't have a formal education in that sort of sense.
I don't think I could do the job now. I don't think I'd get the opportunity. I don't think it would be there, because I worry now, Sam, about people who want to be us, who look at us and think, that's the job I want to do. If my son says to me, Dad, I want to do what you're doing, I don't know how he goes about it, because it used to be the commercial station and the BBC station in the city would both commentate on the matches.
And there's none of that now.
None of that. I don't know where you go and learn it. It's a real shame. I mean, it's better for us because we've got less competition.
You also did some presentation as well, didn't you? You did the Fletch and Sav on the television. Yeah. You've done 6:06 with Sav as well. Yeah. You've done the Friday Night Football Social, I think it's called, on Five Live, yeah, that you do now with JJ. Yeah. Do you sort of enjoy doing the presenting, or did you enjoy doing the presenting as much? You had that relationship with Robbie that took off really quickly, didn't you?
Yeah, I enjoyed that a lot. I've been fortunate, really, that I've worked with two people that I enjoyed doing it with, so that helps. But again, the TV presentation, that was a telephone call from Grant and said, how do you fancy having a show? And I'm like, well, I have no idea. He said, oh, you'll be fine. And again, it was a new channel, so we were trying different things so you could do it. And we knew that some things would work and some things wouldn't, and that went well. But again, that's a different, it's a different skill. I think in an ideal world, we'd all like to do a bit of everything. But I've always had a belief at some stage, you've got to try and lay a marker down and be something. Yeah. And you've got to try and be, you've got to set yourself the goal to try and be the best at something that you do. Yeah. I don't proclaim I'm ever going to be the best football commentator. I won't. But that's my goal now. So on a daily basis, I'm trying to improve that job, trying to get better at that. I think if all of a sudden you're trying to be the best football commentator on telly, you're trying to be the best football commentator on the radio, you're trying to be the best football presenter doing something else, you've got no chance. You'll just end up being okay at all of them. But I think I took a view that I wanted to be, try and be the main commentator here at BT and do all the big games.
You also do and have done NFL.
Yeah.
Now, commentating on NFL,
yeah,
and commentating on Premier League football, how much of a difference is there? I mean, it's a completely different game for a start.
Well, you know the funny thing, you know, I mean, you'll be the same as me. You'll have watched football commentators and you'll think, I like them and I like them a bit more than that and I'm not too keen on that. And you kind of pull a few bits of the style out and then you'll add your own little bit into the mix and then that's you. With the NFL, I'd never heard anybody do it on the radio before. So I just did what I thought. So it was, there was a lot less pressure. It was quite enjoyable because the bosses weren't going to turn around and say, no, you don't do it like that, because they didn't know either. So as long as it sounded okay and the people listening to it enjoyed it, you could pretty much do it how you wanted. So I just kind of turned up and thought, I mean, I love the sport anyway. I love the NFL anyway. I followed it for ages. I know a lot about it to get by in that way. And I had a great summariser, Rocky Boyman, who played in the NFL, won a Super Bowl. He's brilliant. And his career's gone now to ESPN, and he's doing big college games over there. He's great. But it was that was just a case of, like, let's turn up, we'll kind of describe what we see. It was really authentic of, this is what I can see happening in front of you, and let's hope you like it. And it was really well received, actually. So I really miss doing it now, because TalkSport got the rights, so we don't do it anymore on Five Live. But I used to really enjoy it. I think I did six or seven in a row, which, again, that was kind of something that you were never going to do that. So yeah, to get the chance to do that was amazing, really. So I miss doing that.
One question before I let you go. BT have done things slightly differently to other broadcasters, and they were maybe the first to really embrace three commentators, yeah, the main commentator and two summariser. How difficult does that make it for you, or does it make it easier for you?
I think it's fine for me, because I'd done that on the radio before. So trying to cram three voices into a radio commentary is even more difficult. You'll have experienced that, because you're all talking all the time. There's a lot more natural breaks. And I just find, from my standpoint as a commentator, that you do even less, because you think, well, I want to give these guys the gaps because I want their knowledge. So I do less when I've got a three-man team than when we do a two-man team. I'm lucky, too, that there's no ego with the lads I do it with. So I tend to do the three-man team with Glenn tends to be the constant, who you've worked with, who's great. Macca, 75-80% of the time, is the other one, who's superb and the nicest fella in the world to work with. And then JJ would often slot in and do that as well. So they're all really giving themselves on the gantry. Nobody wants to be the dominant voice, so it makes that work.
Listen, thank you very much for giving us the time.
My pleasure.
Cheers for inviting us into your Winnebago.
Does this make me a geek officially now?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm now officially a geek.
I try to work on the assumption that I think you and I are one of the only two commentators that aren't geeks. That's
yeah,
what I tell everyone.
I'll go for that, yeah. Yeah, you've got to say it now. You put it on the record.
Tweets the geeks at AFC Geeks, or get in touch on Instagram.
Interesting there hearing Darren speak sort of about the death of local radio and the lack of opportunities. It felt a little bit doom and gloom, didn't it, Sam? But I think what he was trying to get at is that those local radio stations don't exist anymore, do they?
I thought it was quite an uplifting story, actually. I thought that, you know, it's someone coming from a background like Darren did, doing ceilings for a dodgy building company and ending up being one of the nation's best commentators is a really good story. I think actually might have misconstrued what he was trying to say there. I think from his point of view, and something that I certainly have felt over the last couple of years, Darren and I worked in local radio across the country in different places. And local commercial radio, as you know, you worked at Capital, which was Red Dragon down in South Wales. It's a heritage brand, and lots of these little radio stations have been swallowed up by big conglomerates now, and a lot of the programs networking and a lot of the programming is not coming from its local area, and the law has been changed recently, so that's only going to be the case more so going forward. And I think Crook and I used to work at a radio station in Portsmouth where we did all of our early commentaries, and he started down there, you know, and the idea that that radio station no longer exists, like a lot of other radio stations, probably pains him as much as it pains me.
Yeah, it's a real shame. And to the point where I was coming through, those local stations were dropping off one by one. I started at a little radio station called Nation Radio, but they didn't really have a budget to send anyone out to go to football matches. So I used to get accreditation through them, and I used to sit in the press box and record myself as the goals went in, really worried that someone might be like, what's she doing?
Yeah,
and then on the final whistle, I used to do like a 1:30 report and then send it across to the news team. And then I'd go, it was Brendan Rodgers down at Swansea at the time, and then I'd go and record his press conference, and I'd go home and make on Adobe Audition a report including his answers, and I'd just compile it all. And actually, by doing loads of those games, that's how I got all my stuff together to send to Soccer Saturday in the end, just by going unpaid and going to do it on Saturday afternoon.
Crook can tell you how he started in local radio commentary.
This is not dissimilar to John Champion's origin story, is it? It involves a lot of alcohol, and yours truly. Yeah, basically, Sam came round to my flat one evening, and I cheekily said I could do your job. He was a commentator, then I was a written journalist. He said, okay, yeah, whatever. I said, no, I'll prove it. So he played a game of FIFA on the PlayStation against my nephew Adam. And I commentated. We drank the best part of a litre of whiskey between us at this stage. And he turned around at the end and said, actually, you're pretty good. You fancy doing Pompey Gillingham with me in the FA Cup next weekend? That's where it all began for me.
It's a true story.
Amazing.
True story.
With more pens than friends, this is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Now, we've all been watching games and said to ourselves, he should have scored from there, Manolo Gagliardini, or he should have had a hat-trick. Now, we as broadcasters have a new method of quantifying all those spurn chances.
Mm. Yeah, even by our standards, this might be the geekiest topic we have covered on the podcast so far. We are, of course, talking about expected goals and why it's becoming more and more prevalent when preparing for a commentary. This still gets me confused, so Sam, please explain.
I'm not going to profess to be an expert on this, but I'll try and get through it. Ask any questions as we go along. Be prepared to interrupt me, I don't mind. You've seen this flash up on Match of the Day. Those of us who have looked into betting quite sort of detailed and spending time in analytical departments at football clubs would have been used to them talking about this. This level of complex metrics is now common in football. A lot of football clubs do this. It originated in baseball, I think. Modern coaches absolutely swear by it. And bean counters, so the CEOs and the accountants, they love it because in their head, they can actually make sense of it because it's proper data. What is it? Well, expected goals was developed because the scoreline in football, as you know, is usually quite tight, isn't it? You know, it's a low-scoring game, right? So you usually have 1-0, 2-0, 2-2, whatever. And it doesn't really tell you the whole story of the game. So a company devised this idea where basically each shot, every shot on goal, is given a value based on its chance of going in. How that's worked out is because they use data from millions of years of historical games, shots, goals, everything. So they sort of have a criteria of how to apply it. An open goal 1 yard out is a 0.9. A shot from the halfway line with a goalkeeper and five defenders in front of the goal is a 0.1. Imagine that it's like a percentage chance, really, and the figures range from 0 to 1. Those shots are added together over the match, and that gives you expected goals.
Sorry, have I missed? So do they do that from the match before then? Am I being really thick here?
No. So well, you can do it from the match before. You can do it from the season so far and average it out.
Okay, right, fine. You average it out, yeah.
On Match of the Day, for example, they will show what the expected goals would have been for that game. So, for example, if you watch the Fulham versus Cardiff game, it's 4-2 to Cardiff, but actually the expected goals, I think, is around about 2.01 and 2.02. So it's actually quite an even game, but Cardiff have made the most of their chances. So they're exceeding their level, whereas Fulham aren't hitting their mark. So you can sort of see that over trends over the course of the season. So, for example, the year when Swansea were relegated, the year before, the analytics were saying that even though this team were mid-table, they're actually the worst in the league. So the sensible punters who had studied those analytics then had them to go down the next season, and they duly did. And the reason I mention this is because Manchester City are the best team in the league. Obviously, we all know that. We've seen it with our own eyes. But as Crook mentioned right at the beginning of the programme, the Premier League table is really tight at the moment. However, if you look at the expected goals tally, you'll see that Arsenal are punching above their weight and they're unlikely to keep their current form going. Spurs aren't really as good as we think. Chelsea are better than probably we thought and are probably overachieving at the moment, which I think we can all agree. And Liverpool are excellent, but City's analytical numbers are off the chart. Their expected goals against, so the amount that they are expected to let in, is 0.54, which is the lowest anywhere. And the amount they're expected to score each game is 2.8 per match. It's off the chart. Honestly, it's worth looking at the website, understat.com, and it will really come into focus for you very, very easily.
That's really good. If you're a betting person, I'm not particularly, but my husband's sticking the ackers on every weekend, blames me when he doesn't get the result in the game I'm covering. But I'm going to get him on that website so he stops moaning.
Yeah, I reckon. I actually think it's a really... Well, it is a useful stat for people who do bet, because all the professional gamblers use this as a measure in the way of they assessing football matches. And it's basically putting a value on performance, which you can't do any other way, or reliably you can't do any other way.
It's interesting because Mark Hughes has been ranting on every week about the fact that Southampton are creating so many chances. I think only the top four in the league have created more goal-scoring chances, but they've got the lowest conversion rate in the league. So does that suggest then, based on what you're saying, that sooner or later Southampton are going to improve and start climbing the table? Because they're still going to have Manolo Gagliardini up front. He's not going to suddenly start scoring week in, week out, is he?
Well, at the moment, their expected goals is for the season is 11.2, and their actual goals this season is 6. So they are creating more chances than they are scoring. So ultimately, they will score more goals going forward. That and I suppose, in a sense, he is proving this statistic for us. Oh, you don't like it, do you? You don't like it. You're such a Luddite, though, aren't you? This is a guy who's got a Samsung Galaxy S5.
I'm old school. Expected goals don't win football matches. Players on the pitch win football matches.
It's not about that, though, is it? It's not about saying expected goals win it. It's about the data giving you a better picture of what happened in the previous game and the games before, and how it may influence it going forward. Look, we all know that injuries, refereeing decisions, missed chances, they all play a part, you know, but weather conditions play a part. But this gives you a more informed position from which to make a prediction.
I'm sure Huddersfield fans, when they're in the Championship next season, will be delighted to know that they should have stayed up on expected goals.
Well, they should have got something out of the game on Saturday on expected goals. Their expected goals was very close to Liverpool's. So, and I was at the match, I saw it. They should have got something from it, but they can't finish. And that is a massive, massive problem. And it's all right saying that the expected goals tells you you should be doing this. It just tells you that one form of the game is going well for them. We know that Huddersfield haven't got a forward, so we can then add that piece of information into the data that we're seeing and saying unless they get someone who can convert those chances, they will go down.
It's amazing, isn't it? Because you can level that accusation at pretty much 12 teams in the league that they don't have anyone to stick the ball in the net. I watched Palace against Everton at the weekend. Everton very lucky to win 2-0, but neither of them had a goal scorer. Wilfried Zaha on his own isn't going to score enough goals to keep Crystal Palace in the Premier League. Everton haven't got a natural goal scorer. Richarlison for me is still better out wide. Southampton, we've mentioned. There's so many clubs in the Premier League that lack that killer instinct. Is that just because there's a dearth of quality strikers out there at the moment?
Well, yeah, there is a dearth of quality striker. I mean, I even look at someone, if you think that Morata, Alvaro Morata, who's scored 3 goals all season and has had about 500 chances, is worth 60-plus million quid. I mean, it tells you that there's a lack of quality in that position. But I've been watching youth football for quite a long time now, and I think that one of the problems is we don't breed them anymore.
I think if you look at sort of clubs like Cardiff City, I go down to their presses quite a lot. And tell me who the quality striker is at Cardiff City. You can't.
Well, they don't have one.
They haven't got one. So when you look at their expected goals, have they actually got the quality to tuck them away? That's what I'd come back to on this.
Yeah, well, that's the thing.
And that's the point I'm making with Southampton.
Said to you before about the fact that you take that information and then you use your own eyes and your own information that you've already got, so you know that they haven't got a striker to finish off those chances, and you can make a prediction based on that.
Well, I tell you what, expected goals won't be making me put my money on Southampton to beat Newcastle on Saturday. I can tell you that for nothing.
Mate, yeah, you've got to come into the 21st century. I'm going to Liverpool Red Star Belgrade this week, and on Saturday, Brighton against Wolves. And there's a couple of subplots in that Liverpool Red Star game, isn't there? The Shaqiri being a Kosovan with some anti-Serbian protests in his past. I think that would have been a little bit more controversial if Serbian fans had been allowed to buy tickets, because they invaded a pitch and set off fireworks away in Salzburg in the playoffs. They ain't going to get to go. Where are you going, guys?
Well, I'm at that game at St Mary's. Massive game for Mark Hughes. Southampton against Newcastle. Massive game for both managers, actually, because as we've already alluded to in the programme, I do think the Newcastle fans are now starting to ask questions of Rafa Benitez. His record this season is worse than Steve McLaren when he was sacked. That says something. And for Southampton, 3 wins in 17. Yes, it was much improved against Bournemouth. Bournemouth were poor. Southampton still couldn't take advantage. I still think, whatever you tell me about expected goals, they are going to struggle to put the ball in the back of the net, and they are going to be looking over their shoulders.
I am at Swansea twice this week, as I said. The first game, Tuesday evening, Swansea v Blackburn. Then I'm back in Swansea on Saturday for Swansea against Reading. The Championship incredibly tight at the moment. I mean, from the bottom sort of 3 up to the promotion places, there's not a lot to choose between the middle pack. It's incredibly tight and incredibly exciting as well.
Remember to subscribe and tell everyone about us. Tweet us or Instagram us on @AFCGeeks. Let's try and answer some of the questions we've been sent in over the last week or so.
Darren says, Michelle, did you actually get to park at Brentford last week?
Well, not at the ground, because it was the OB game, which means it was the feature game on the highlights programme for the Championship. But I did manage to go in a school sort of about a 15-minute walk away, which isn't too bad. But then,
the
A4 was closed. Well, you know, the A4 was closed. I did have to drive out past McDonald's, and I shook my head as I drove past, thinking of you, Sam.
It's not me who goes in there, it's him. I just used to run them. that's not a joke. Not a Twitter question as much, but someone contacted me this week to tell me to look out for a growing issue involving Everton, the Premier League, Watford, and the tapping up of Marco Silva. Now, this guy's been pretty convinced all along that the authorities have got something now, clear evidence against Everton. It'd be interesting to see if that is the case. He thinks that they're going to start proceedings against them very shortly. It'll be interesting to see what they can do and what they do do. Ashley Cole and Chelsea and Arsenal was the last tapping up saga, and there was a fine and a suspended points deduction. But I can't see anybody taking any points off someone for tapping up a manager. And to be honest with you, I don't care.
It's a grey area.
Has it.
Yeah.
What makes football special? Why can't you ask someone if they want to come and work for you? I don't get it.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Completely agree with you there, Sam.
Crook, this one is for you. In terms of Southampton, is it true that you go to Southampton every single week?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
And Dave says, then why do you not like us?
Oh. Well, listen, we've had this debate before, haven't we? This is about people who are biased against our club. I have had a lot of stick from certain sections of the St Mary's fan base on Twitter over the last 2 or 3 years. Because, to put it bluntly, I've probably been the one local journalist who's put their head above the parapet and said, look, this is not going well, guys. You're selling your best players. You're replacing them on the cheap with rubbish. Eventually, that's going to catch up with you. I wrote a piece about this for the Telegraph at the weekend. It's a warning to other clubs. I was using it as an example for Bournemouth, of course, because Nathan Ake is being hunted by just about all the big clubs at the moment. This is what happens if you become a selling club. Sooner or later, it will catch up with you. Les Reed is not the miracle worker that he's been made out to be. This black box is nothing more than a myth. Everybody has got the same information as Southampton. They used it very well for a couple of years. They appointed two fantastic managers in Pochettino and Koeman. They've appointed two, possibly three now with Mark Hughes, not so good managers. And it's coming home to roost. Listen, I've got nothing against Southampton. I've got nothing against any club, but I will always give an honest opinion. If you don't like that, unfollow me.
I wrote an article for The Mirror in January 2016, I think it was, Crook, or was it, might have been December 2015. When did they get to the cup final when they played Manchester United? It was 2016, wasn't it? It was after they played Inter Milan in the Europa League. And I just said...
That was 2 years ago this weekend.
This is a disaster. This is a disaster waiting to happen because they don't play the best team in Europe and Southampton haven't won a trophy since 1976. And how can Southampton not want to be a success in the secondary European competition? They can't be too big for that. And I wrote pretty much what you said about them selling every player that ever did anything for them, raking in the money. The owner doesn't want to be there. She wanted to sell at the time. The fans didn't seem to want to be there either. They couldn't even get the PA announcement right for the start of the game. They played the wrong theme tune when the players came out. It was an absolute mess. And I thought, how can this not be the greatest night in your history, playing Inter Milan at home?
Yeah.
Maybe not in your history, but certainly in your recent history. I just didn't get it at all. And I still, to this day, cannot work out how they didn't play their best team. Anyway, I think we're out of time.
Yep, that's all we have time for this week. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. And join us next week, where we'll be joined by, hopefully, one of my Sky Sports colleagues.
Ooh, it's a teaser.
Tweet the Geeks at AFC Geeks or get in touch on Instagram.